Accession number 16855 Real 2.
Major Scott, Real 2.
The noise, of course, of the battle was incredible. Chinese shouting and yelling and blowing their bugles. They had no radio communications at battalion level at all. Everything was done by bugle call. The fusiliers, although not necessarily the fastest in an attack, is indomitable in defence. And of course, we had a lot of ex-coal miners, and they were able to dig much better than the average soldier who's not been used to digging. And I don't think many, if any, of Chinese got into our W Company platoon positions. But the slaughter of the Chinese was appalling. The two forward companies in the battalion bore the brunt of the attack on the battalion area, which went on all day of the 23rd of April, St. George's Day. Now, St. George's Day is the regiment's saint's day. We wear a red and white hackle, and in the cap badge at the time, there is St. George and the Dragon. X and Z companies had to withdraw, and Z company, who were opposite us on the other side of the ridge, on the other side of the valley, was partially overrun. From where we were, we watched attempts to retake those positions, but they all failed. On the morning of 25th of April, having been battling since midnight on the 22nd, all the 23rd, and most of the 24th, on the morning of 25th, we had orders to withdraw. I had to, again, we couldn't just all walk off the hill. We had to leave one platoon and its platoon headquarters and the part of the company headquarters and the company commander on the hill whilst we withdrew. So I led two platoons out and part of the company headquarters down the hill past battalion headquarters to get out of the valley. The valley was some miles in length and there were hills on either side. And it was a supply route on a sort of a road down in the valley. And I stopped at the when we got to battalion headquarters and got on the radio to my company commander, Charles Mitchell, and said I would wait there for him until he and the 3rd platoon were safely off the hill. I'm told unceremoniously to bugger off. and I was to do as I was told. In other words, get out of it. So I decided not to leave these two platoons down the road, down the valley, which I had been told to do, I think, but to get onto the high ground on the east side, not on the opposite side to what we had been on, because I couldn't see any Chinese up there, and I reckoned if they'd gotten past and bypassed us, they'd be on the west ridge. I got these two platoons up onto the ridge, and we started walking down there. But it was fairly heavily treed, and got a lot of shrubs and things up there. So we were concealed quite a lot of the time. But whenever we had to cross open ground, we were shot at by the Chinese from the other side of the valley. Luckily, no one was hit, as I said. When we found our way to a forming up point some miles further south, sadly, Charles Mitchell had been shot in the stomach, but had been put on a Centurion tank of a squadron of the 8th Hussars who were helping us with this withdrawal in the valley. And he actually did survive and reached what was a mobile surgical hospital, an American-run, near Taichung, way to the south of Seoul, where they operated on him. Before further evacuation to Japan and then back to the United Kingdom. I didn't meet him again for a year or so more. So the 3rd platoon, which had been left on the hill, were commanded by an officer called Bill Cooper, who is mentioned frequently in Max Hastings' account of the Korean campaign. They were taken prisoner, and some members of the company headquarters staff. So, having reached the forming up point, I saw my first Chinaman who'd been captured, and he was looking very disdainful and very cocky, and really rather long to clobber him, but presumably he was giving information to intelligence people. So I found myself now in a transport which had come for us, leading what was left of the company right away back over the Han River and onto the what they call the Kimpo Peninsula, which is the west of Seoul City, where B echelon staff were waiting for us. They'd been able to get back there faster. They had a meal ready for us, and inevitably we found ourselves in a school where we fed and slept for 24 hours on the stretch. I was now commanding W Company and much in need of reinforcements, having lost a platoon and having had some casualties in the other two. We were, however, in a rest area, and it was quite, we were not actually in tactical positions. We learned that there were some Royal Naval ships anchored in the straits off the west coast of the Kimpo Peninsula, near Incheon, and that the battalion had arranged that parties of officers and sailors could visit the ships for meals and see a cinema and other comforts, which the Navy are very generous with. So I took a party from my company onto HMS Amethyst of Yangtze River fame. You remember the story of that, where we enjoyed traditional Royal Naval hospitality. We were given a hero's welcome. So much so that we really felt a bit embarrassed. Eventually, we took up positions, the tactical defense position, on the high ground overlooking the Han River. And whilst there, reinforcements joined us. These were national servicemen. Remember, we hadn't any national servicemen when we first went out to Korea. And so they were not the tried and recalled wartime experienced soldiers. We were at pains to assure them that the artillery fire they could hear some distance away was not actually aimed at us. It was most likely at the Chinese, aimed at the Chinese. With some 35 reinforcements, I think we had, or maybe in a bit more, coming into the company, I decided, rightly or wrongly, to create three new platoons. I didn't think it was right that I should have one platoon of national servicemen and two others with all the ex-regulars. And I left it to platoon commanders and platoon sergeants to work out how the complement of nine sections should be made up. And the sections commanders would have some, one or two maybe, ex-regulars, and the rest national service. Well, we're getting on very well towards the end of my experiences in Korea, but there did follow a time after this, a period of tranquility, until the end of May on the Kimpo Peninsula, which enabled us to absorb these reinforcements, do some patrolling and some training. We then moved back to the Imjin River area, where we had been at the time of the Imjin battle, and sat about digging, wiring, laying mines against any possible future incursions or attacks by the Chinese hordes. W Company, and the others, carried out a number of sallies across the Han River, supported by a troop of 8 Hussar Centurion tanks, and of course a gunner forward observation officer. On the first run of these armour-supported deep patrols, company strong, we halted at the crossing point on the river, where I found that the BBC had set up a sound recording unit and asked for some gun and mortar fire to be put down as effect, side effect, on the other side of the river. By today's standards, I reckon that recording unit was primitive, because they were recording onto 78-type records. We never did hear the result of their recording. We did once run into a small North Korean or Chinese foot patrol, and we exchanged small arms fire, and they were keen to get away from us as they could, and they fled across the open paddy fields into distant high ground. We hurried them up a bit with the odd round of heavy mortars. These sallies did something to relieve the monotony of life on our hill once we were well and truly dug in and wired and mined. I arranged for my cookhouse to be at the bottom of the hill, which was the most unpopular because it meant the sailors had to get off their hunkers and walk down the hill for every meal. It gave them some exercise. In July or August, at about the time of the formation of the 1st Commonwealth Division, I personally left Korea and handed over my company to another officer to fly back to England. I was to attend a regular commissions board in Westbury, the regiment having agreed to have me as a regular officer. I decided to stay in the army if I could.
Just going back to the Battle of the Imjin, how frightening was it as far as you were concerned?
I think it was a difficult time because I hadn't actually got a command. Platoon commanders were directing their own platoons and dealing with the Chinese coming up. Charles Mitchell was commanding the company, and he had a lot to think about. I hadn't, apart from just witnessing it all. And it was very difficult, actually. I found it very difficult. If I'd had something to do and a command to execute, I would have been happier. But, I mean, it was the same with all the company seconds in Iran. The policy was not for the company seconds in command to stay back in an echelon further back behind the battalion wherever it was. It was a policy that we stayed with your companies. And that was held to be the case right from the moment we started in the campaign.
Can you tell me about your experiences in Burma, starting with what unit you were in then, please?
Well, I was joined in Burma, the 2nd Battalion, the Green Howards. I'd been commissioned in India at Bangalore, Officers Training School, having gone out to India and in the earliest in 1944, in one of the first convoys through the Mediterranean when it had been opened. And I think I ought to tell you a little bit about before we actually got into Burma, because it's quite interesting in a way. I think there are not many Indian words left in the vocabulary of the soldiers in the British Army today, but you might still hear one saying that somebody had gone a bit Deolali. Deolali was the name of a transit camp northeast of Bombay, and it was a pretty grim sort of place to be in. I was there after being commissioned at the Officer Training School in Bangalore in mid-1944. And then, knowing I was going to go to 2 Green Howards in Burma, I had to attend a jungle training course in Bhopal. In Bhopal State, where they had that tragedy not all that long ago. I had to learn a little bit about jungle warfare. I have very little memories of what happened there. I do remember some wild Tonga races into the local bazaar from the camp, near the Tonga being a little sort of surrey with a fringe on top, a two-wheel job. And we used to give them an extra rupee to race against another one. That was rather fun. Rather silly, but fun. I remember some being posted then off to to get across into Burma, firstly by rail to a place called Sirajganj on the river Jamna, northeast of Calcutta, and getting on a river steamer there, together with about 70 other British officers, a lot of whom were ex-Royal Artillery officers who had been rebadged as infantry, much to their disgust, and posted out to the Far East for the war in Burma. Anyway, we were in that steamer for most of Christmas Day on the 1944, and we went by rail from a place called Chandpur, further down the Jamna, to Camilla. On the train journey to Camilla, at night, on the narrow gauge link, rail link to Camilla, we only had hurricane batteries and hurricane lamps for lighting in this train. And one clown kicked over one of these paraffin batteries in the loo, which hadn't got a door on it anyway, and of course paraffin went everywhere and the train caught fire. I'll never forget that. We were going so slowly that we managed to get somebody to get out of the train, run up the line, tell the driver to stop, which he did, and he came back with a bucket of water and a blanket soaked in water, and we put the fire out. But if we'd have been going fast, it would have been much more dangerous. At Camilla, it was another large transit camp, where I was told I was to join us. I think it was the Staffordshire Regiment in Burma, despite having been commissioned into Green Hearts. Luckily, when wandering in the bazaar the next day, I ran into a Green Hearts soldier in a jeep, who turned out to be the driver of the CO of the second town of Green Hearts, who told me that after a recent battle they had had near Cox's Bazaar, further south on the coast, the town was short of platoon commanders. So I asked him to drive me back to camp, where I collected my kit and left a goodbye note in the camp office and went off to join the 2nd Green Hearts. And didn't have to go to the staff. I'd never heard anything more of that. 2nd Green Hearts was part of a brigade in the 26th Indian Division. And in each brigade in the division, I think there was one British battalion, one Gurkha and one Indian. And whilst there, I met Admiral Mountbatten for the first time. I met him again several times in India in the mid-60s. He came to address the battalion and hinted at some combined seaborne operation in which we would be involved. This turned out to be an attack on the Japs on the island of Rumree. So we embarked on a troop ship in Chittagong and sailed the 250-odd miles south to Rumree, an island very close to the mainland of Burma, near Arakan, an island about 50 miles long and 25 wide. We met up with the landing craft, infantry, LCIs, and supported by Royal Naval guns, including HMS King George VI, a battleship, and some airstrikes. We stormed ashore. There wasn't a Jap to be seen, only a dead cow. An ex-butcher in the company knew how to deal with that, and we had fresh meat for a few days. There were no signs of Japs in the area which we were in. We did a lot of patrolling, but the word was that they'd mostly escaped to the mainland. Nevertheless, one had to be very careful when approaching villages on these patrols, in case there were Japs there, and there had been cases where soldiers had been shot up on the mainland as well. In one village I went to with a strong patrol, I met the village elder, who turned out to be a professor of English in the Rangoon University, who had moved back to Rumree Island when the Japs invaded to look after his village. That's where he came from. I hired some canoes from him and some rowers, and we set off on a 3 or 4 day river patrol, where I had about a dozen as my soldiers with me, I think. I had not told the professor how long we would be away, for obvious reasons, but he knew, and I think probably from the drums. They still communicated with drums, between village to village. Waiting for us when we got back to him was a curry feast on a laid out on trestle tables and white cloths. I sat with him at a small table on which stood a bottle of Leon Perrin's Worcester sauce. And I said, how did this manage to get hold of this? He said, well, I've been saving it up for the first British troops that came here. That was a rather nice touch. After Rumrie, it was a case of a series of small combined operations up the numerous chongs or rivers, which were supported by Royal Naval frigates as far as they could go. And they couldn't go further than a point where they were unable to turn. They were quite deep, these chongs. We ran into small parties of Japs now and again, and in minor skirmishes. I seemed to be destined to lead quite a number of these long-distance patrols, lasting in the up to a week. They were physically very exhausting because of the climate and the fact that if we were going for a week, we were carrying quite heavy loads on our backs and, of course, with no transport. And invariably, when I got back to the starting point, I found the battalion had moved on further south, just leaving behind a section to guide us on and some rations. We had a bit of a battle just south of Tongup, which was on the mainland opposite the southern tip of Rumrie Island. And we had trouble with some Japanese guns, which they almost superhumanly had dragged up to the top of the ridges and the hills. I can't remember how we dealt with them, probably with some 3-inch mortar fire, because that was the only sort of weapon of that nature we had within the battalion. We didn't have any gunner support. But the Japanese were always well dug in. But they were on their way out. They knew it. And they weren't likely to, we felt, they weren't likely to launch a full-scale attack against us. They were adopting defensive positions to give time for the withdrawal to get proceed, I think. It was about then when I was wrecking a hill which we thought was not occupied by Japs, and I had a small section with me. I got in the way of a Jap rifle bullet, and it must have been fired by my optic Jap, because he was only 20 yards away, and he virtually missed me and shot me in the shoulder. At the same time, I was shot in the back by a member of the so-called Burmese traitor army with a 12-bore shotgun. So I had to be flown out to a hospital on Rumrie. Well, they dug out a lot of lead pellets and patched up a small wound in my shoulder.
How did you know it was from one of the Burma troops?
Because that was they were working with the Japanese, and they were normally armed with something like that. When I rejoined the battalion, not all, about a fortnight later, I suppose, I found that we were now in the 82nd West African Division. 26th Indian Division having been pulled out to form part of the force being assembled to retake Rangoon. In the last few weeks in the war, we had to endure the dreary 50 or 60 mile march down the coast to Sandaway. Not, as far as I can remember, meeting any opposition at all, except from the leeches, the prickly heat, the fact we had no medical stores, we were short rations, and a lot of the soldiers' boots had worn out. And we had the monsoon as well to compete with. At Sandaway, we took over the whole village virtually, and particularly the village school. We became air supplied, and the war ended when we were there. But the air dropping zone of ration things was on a football pitch by the town school. The rum ration was always the last thing to be dropped, and they never put a parachute around it. They free dropped it, and it came down in a crate lined with straw. So we used to line the touchline when our cookery was ready, and when the last straw packed crate had bounced on the field, we raced to rescue the rum because the corks frequently came out on impact. And rum-soaked straw wouldn't have been much use. After a day or two, the RMA regimental medical officer and unfortunately went slightly mad. There was a battalion sick parade every day of about 100. We were in a very bad shape. I think we were down to a strength of about 250 or 300. 250, I think. There was practically nothing in the AMI, I'm going to say, in the form of medical stores, and it was too much for him. So the parson took over as a medical officer. Now that was my experience in Burma.
Kukris, did you say?
Yes.
You had kukris?
Yes, yes. Well, you needed them in a jungle. No, the same, just like the Gurkha kukri.
How did the Japanese enemy in Burma compare with the Chinese enemy in Korea?
Well, it's completely different. Completely different. And we were chasing them out. And I personally didn't, apart from that one or two minor skirmishes, I was shot at a few times, and I've already described. But they were in retreat. They weren't there in those huge numbers. They weren't attacking us, and they were quite different. And of course, they were probably a bit more demoralized, knowing that they were being pushed back. Not the Chinese. Yeah.
What dates were you in active service in Burma, approximately?
I joined the battalion on about New Year's Day, I think, 1945. It's on my 21st birthday, so it'd be the third. I had my 21st birthday then. We were in a rest area. The battalion had been at this Cox's Bazaar battle.